Well, good morning. You all sound ready to start on time. I'm Rick Barton. I'm the co-director of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project here at CSIS, along with Karen Von Hippel. And on behalf of John Hamry, our president, and Steve Flanagan, the head of the International Security Program, welcome. It's good to have you here on a Monday morning so early. What we'd like to do today is to announce the official release of our report, which many of you should have, so the executive summary and the recommendation on your seats, along with the internet connection to the final report. What's available right now is the final pre-publication draft. The PDF version that should be going up later this week will be the official version that we'll have printed up in the next couple of weeks for those of you who want hard copies and don't want to have to download everything from the internet, but it is all available there, and we hope that you will, in fact, look to it in that place. What I'd like to start out by doing, I've asked our distinguished panelists today to each take about 10 minutes to make some brief remarks about our report, and then to highlight their own thoughts on the issues that are facing Pakistan as we lead up to this election in the next week or so, and to many of the other events that are really putting Pakistan on the front pages of all of our newspapers every day as we get up. It obviously is a place of vital concern to its own people, to the region, and to the United States, and we're pleased to have all of you here to hear these panelists. I will start off with a 10-minute section of my own that I hope will give you a quick overview of our report, and then the panelists will speak. In this particular order, Wendy Chamberlain will go first. She is the president of the Middle East Institute. She was the Deputy High Commissioner for Refugees at the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees in Geneva, and was also the ambassador to Pakistan, U.S. Ambassador to Pakistan from 2001 to 2002, just as the two countries' relationships were making another dramatic change. She has a great career of experience in the region, and we're looking forward to hearing her thoughts. Bob Oakley graduated from Princeton many years before I taught there, and yet still managed to reach the top levels of our diplomatic service. He is a wise and widely respected advisor, and Bob was on the National Security Council staff, was hugely involved with Somalia, and served as ambassador to Pakistan from 1998 to 2002, at a time when the United States was winding down its very active engagement in Pakistan. So I think it's Wendy and Bob offer kind of interesting opposite views of how we came into and went out of Pakistan. And then finally, Tezzy Schaefer, who's the director of the CSIS's South Asia program, obviously a clear thinker and a widely respected commentator on Pakistan and the region, and a wonderful colleague, will wrap things up. So what I'd like to do is to really start out by telling you a little bit of what we set out to do, how we did it, some of the things we found, and then very quickly touch on some of our recommendations, and I hope I can do that all in my allotted time. We essentially had a few initial challenges as we looked at Pakistan. The first was that we believe that there are four chronic weaknesses in this entire field of conflict studies, and the first one is an extremely weak ability to anticipate, understand a place, get the context of it right, and we thought that we should look at a tough future case, one that if something were to happen, it would be impossible to avoid, and so we decided to look at Pakistan, not because it was necessarily so fragile or so conflicted at the time, but it certainly had the turbulence that was required to really deserve that kind of special attention. The second thing we looked at is as we talked to people about Pakistan, we heard this constant denial. If something awful happened in Pakistan, it would be too awful. So therefore, we can't really think about it, which led to the reinforcement of the first problem. But the third reason we went to Pakistan is we thought it would be impossible to avoid. that a nuclear country of 170 million people in the most populous region of the world, we couldn't sit on our shores, nor could any other part of the world sit back and say, well, that's not our problem. We feared that there was this great misalignment of what was going on in the country, that the United States was spending a considerable effort in Pakistan, but we didn't think that it was hitting the core problems. And we sort of thought of it this way, that if these were the core problems of the country, this was likely to be U.S. assistance. As we went through our study, we found that that was really quite accurate. And finally, we thought that there was a chance to do something at an early enough date, that if we really got thoughtful people working on this early on, that we could, in fact, make a difference in a place like Pakistan. There was a phrase in a newspaper article last week. Somebody was quoting Joseph Ellis, the historian, and he said that we're doing too much improvising on the edge of catastrophe. And that was really very much captured our feelings about what we saw in Pakistan. So we thought, let's get the United States-Pakistan relationship right now, and it might make a difference. So what do we do, and how do we do it? Well, the first thing we did is we identified a very talented team leader. And we had Craig Cohen, who's many of you know, because probably all of you have been interviewed by him in the last 2 years, who's standing in the back, who really put together a terrific team of people that included Brad Larson, who's also standing in the back, who did a wonderful series of research on all of the pipelines of U.S. assistance. Mark Irvin, who I don't see in the room now, but also was a great help. Shannon Hayden, I think I saw her sitting back here, was also mightily involved in Sabina Sequeira, and then obviously Karen Von Hippel and others in our office. But I'd like to just take a break for a minute, if I could, and invite Craig Cohen to come up, because we'd just like to make a gift to him. So, Craig, if you'd come up, please. Since you lived with this project so long, we thought you'd have something to keep you company for the next 2 years of your life.
Thanks, Rick.
And thank you very much for everything you did. Okay, here you go. We gave Craig a copy of the poster so that he could keep it over the bed of his new house with his new wife and have a reminder of how he spent the first 2 years of his marriage. We interviewed about 100 plus experts here in Washington and in the United States. We had several weeks of travel with Ayub Karim here as our guide through all of Pakistan. Did a wonderful job. We visited from the earthquake areas down to Karachi and in between. We spoke to several hundred people in the country, 150 Pakistanis from former presidents to protesters. One of my Princeton classes worked on Pakistan for an entire semester. You'll see in the course of the full report that there are really over 500 citations, over 200 footnotes for each of the tables. We did a tabletop exercise. We visited Delhi to talk to Pakistani experts in that community. We also connected it to our Afghanistan work, which we've been doing over the last several years. And we've continued to maintain connections with many of the people that we spoke to throughout. So we've tried to have a very active engagement with the community, not to become experts, but to really apply our model and methodology to a place that we thought is a very clear challenge. So very quickly, because I know the others are going to speak to these things as well, so I'll try to summarize as fast as I can some of our findings and then come back for the question and answer period and be part of that for some of the other points, because otherwise I'll violate the time rule, be the first bad example of the day. Our findings, basically, we found that there was really no central aggregating of the United States assistance to Pakistan and a rather significant misunderstanding of how great our assistance is. The common figure that was used when we started out was about, most people thought we were spending about $750 million a year there. We think it's much closer to $2 billion a year when you take in the intelligence money as well. We also found that Pakistan was being dealt with in an incredibly inconstant way, and that it was described as a juggling act. That's the senior diplomats we spoke to really referred to it that way. We found that there was a huge asymmetry of effort, that not enough was being done to reach the Pakistani people, that about 90% of the assistance could be interpreted as going to the military. And in a country with a rich civil society and obviously an incredibly complex population, that there was a huge overdependence on the Pakistani military as our key partner. We felt that there was a failure to recognize the enormity of the place, that the perspective that almost all Americans have been developing has been driven largely by the Afghanistan problem. And so we approach Pakistan through Islamabad, and then we travel almost immediately to the northwest to see what's going wrong when there are obviously the bulk of the population of the country is elsewhere. We did discover that there is, in fact, a $2 billion a year or so flow of money, and that while many people in Washington think that's a lot of money, it would be a lot of money in Haiti or in some other smaller country. But in Pakistan, it is not the dominant issue of the time. And furthermore, Pakistanis don't particularly like the attitude that comes with the money. So that while we feel that there's a lack of appreciation here, there is, in fact, a lack of appreciation there. And that this obviously colors a huge amount of our relationship. We've also felt that the post-earthquake assistance had been extremely well received, and so there are channels of receptivity in the country that need to be pursued. I think since the others are likely to speak about some of our more Pakistan-related recommendations, that in the little bit of time I have, I should probably just maybe go over the five golden rules that we developed coming out of this study for making U.S. assistance more effective in these large recipient countries, because I think they really do have a huge influence, obviously in Pakistan, but in other countries that we're working in. It's our feeling that for American assistance to be effective in large aid recipient nations like Pakistan, it must go beyond transactional quid pro quo assistance and address the key drivers of conflict, instability, and extremism in the country. America needs to recognize that this new phase of its relationship with Pakistan will last 25 years or more. And there's no walking away as occurred during the 1990s. Pakistan is vital to our interests and to the region and to the entire Muslim world. What the United States does now will help lay the groundwork for what will arise in Pakistan in the next generation. The U.S. administration is already making some important strides in this regard, but in general, such a forward-looking outlook has been subjected to short-term security objectives and not well integrated into an overall strategy. So we set out five broad goals. The first is that the United States must broaden the partnerships. We have to get to know the place better, and we must engage with more people. The second, we must increase the transparency, because it is the key to trust and good decision-making. The third, we must become more catalytic and more flexible. We can't just do the familiar. We can't just provide what's already in our inventory or on our military bases. We have to address the challenges directly. The fourth, we must develop an integrated strategy aligned with resources. A joined-up United States government is much more effective than the current model. And fifth, we must integrate hard and soft power. There is a need for a balance in terms of for our own effectiveness, and also for showing the breadth of America's strength. These are all areas for improvement in Pakistan, and again, I invite you to look at the more detailed report and also the summaries that are on your table for the full set of recommendations which we offer in the report. So, Wendy, I'll turn over to you, and thank you all very much.
Well, thank you, Rick. And I'd like to really thank Rick and Karen Von Hippel and Craig Cohen and the many other experts that that participated in this study. You know, I have for a long time felt the need for a study just of this sort. It asks the questions and it gives the essential answers that American policymakers need to consider when we begin to look at what our relationships will be with Pakistan for the longer term. And I'd like to, as Rick suggested, highlight just a couple of points that particularly impressed me. There were so many points that we can't really go over them all, but this is just the beginning, I think, opens up many lines of inquiry, which I hope will be pursued in the future. The first point is that the report provides solid documentation for the point that our assistance is not focused enough on people and their most impressing concerns and aspirations. You know, I've made this point a number of times in the past, but it's been based on intuition. And intuition simply isn't good enough. We needed the research and the documentation and the sound methodology that CIS has provided, and I commend them. The report pulls together various streams of aid, as Rick points out, that we've invested in Pakistan and in our relations since 9/11. And as far as I know, I don't think this has been done before, and this is a major contribution. But the conclusions confirm what we all feared, that we were indeed investing a great deal in Pakistan, $10 billion since 2001, but that it was overwhelmingly going to the military and military assistance, that this aid is not aimed at addressing the needs of the Pakistani people enough, but rather on our own short-term counterterrorism efforts primarily along the border of Afghanistan, and that it's a big country. And because our efforts are not addressing the underlying lines of fault lines within the Pakistani society, it's perceived to be working against the people and thusly into actually aiding the militants within Pakistan. And in the words of the report, the United States has less influence in Pakistan than we think or that the Pakistanis fear. So I think the report draws the right conclusion, that U.S. long-term policy with Pakistan must focus on meeting the aspirations of the people, and nothing I have seen or read in recent years is more important than this point. My second point is that the report offers a straightforward explanation as to why a coherent and effective policy on our part towards Pakistan has somehow eluded us. And in a word, it's been our own lack of clarity. Of purpose. I was particularly struck, and I'll draw your attention to Table 2.1 on the draft I have on page 21. This outlines the different approaches among American policymakers. Status quo view versus the activist critique. And the chart, for those of you who don't have it in front of you, pairs the views up something like this. Musharraf is doing the best he can to root out the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda. Musharraf is playing a double game. Islamism is on the rise and military rule prevents its ascent. Vice, the myth of the Islamic peril is used to justify anti-democratic force. Musharraf has sought peace with India. Vice, Musharraf has refused to address the Kashmiri militancy. And it goes on. Any expert in Pakistan who's been dealing with it since 9/11, and that's just about everybody, has a view. Policy positions are coherently, cogently argued and firmly held. And as this chart points out, assumptions on Pakistan can be diametrically opposed and often counterproductive. I found the chart humbling because I suppose I too am guilty of taking these positions one vice the other. The point that the study makes clearly, and that is that our efforts in Pakistan have been overly focused on counterterrorism to the point that we've misunderstood or misconstrued what's going on in the rest of this vast country, and that this is counterproductive and, frankly, I believe, unsustainable. So this is a timely report. The stability of Pakistan qua Pakistan and the welfare of its people are just too important to us, to the Pakistanis, and to the region to get it wrong. One very disturbing example of this point tracks the U.S. approval ratings after the earthquake. Rick just mentioned it, but I'll make a point here. American popularity within Pakistan soared because of our quick and effective response to the people in the earthquake, from a level of 23% to 45%, as reported in the report. But that it dropped again a few months later, in November, by January, it had dropped down to a low of 15%, and there it seems to hover. Why? Well, the event that precipitated this fall was a U.S. Predator attack on the madrasa in Bajor along the Afghan border that killed many civilians. And it alienated a whole nation. It was across the country. It was a long way away. But it had an effect on the entire nation. So I endorse the report's conclusion that the U.S. must develop a comprehensive interagency integrated policy approach, and that this process must lead to a definition of our relations for Pakistan. We all have to come together on this. And if we fail to do this, we're condemned to undercutting our own broader interests, wasting our investments, stunting Pakistan's potential for development, and endangering the region. Now, a third point that I'd like to make is that the report hammers home the horrifying truth that a plan B for Pakistan kind of eludes us. The other example of a foreign adventure in which we stubbornly rejected the advice of many to develop a plan B was Iraq, and we all know the consequences of that. Just to dial back to my own experiences there, in the early months following 9/11, I believe, because I was part of it, that the U.S. made the right decision in trusting Musharraf and supporting him. And I think in the early days that the U.S., the thinking in those days, in the early days of 2001, was that we should address quickly and effectively and overwhelmingly those threats that Musharraf faced to keep him strong, because he was our ally and we needed him as we went into Afghanistan. What did he face? He faced uprising in the streets, a faltering economy, a shunned military, and a deeply ingrained view within the population that the United States, were just going to abandon them again as we had after the Soviets' withdrawal. So our response was quick, and that was to provide military assistance, stabilize the economy with large grant aid so that it could qualify for the World Bank loan, buy down its debt, and we lifted the sanctions, and we engaged with Pakistan on all levels. And it seemed to work. But the embassy in those days also recommended that we provide immediate education, health, and infrastructure support to the Fatah so that Musharraf's central government could go in immediately to the Fatah, plug those valleys, gain support from the people. Now, I'm glad to see that the administration is now talking about providing $750 million. But you know what? This is 6 years later, and we didn't do it then, and I believe that we may be too late to have the impact that we want. Timing is important, and that's the element that I think we need to think about as we read this report. Timing is important. Our initial recommendations were meant to be immediate, but they weren't meant to be enduring. We did recommend a long-term plan at that time. We recommended that USAID be established to implement this longer-term plan, and that it primarily be focused on education, secondarily on health and democracy. And the other dual pillar of our recommendation then was for longer-term aid was to help develop a professional, disciplined Pakistani civilian police. This also did not happen. The CSIS report admirably recommends strengthening the police, but I'd like to give it a little greater emphasis. We all recognize the huge influence that the Pakistani army plays in the society. We also recognize the critical importance of safety and security for a civilian population. It's the primary responsibility of government. But we argued in 2002, and I still think it's important today, that more balance need to be developed in Pakistan's national security plan, and that police development had been largely ignored. Today, we hear complaints coming out of Pakistan from those who are very critical of the current government and our role there, that the army is intruding into the domestic security affairs throughout the country, deep into the villages within the countryside. There simply is a vacuum for security and safety in Pakistan, but it should not be filled by a national army. Within our government, there are strongly held views that the U.S. should not get involved in police training, lest it be tied to police abuses should they occur in the future. And that, moreover, I mean, I think there's no single agency within the U.S. government that owns overseas police training. But I'd like to argue that this shouldn't stop us. The U.S. did a really admirable job in both Kosovo and Bosnia in police training and development. And we should have done it in the very early days in Iraq, and we didn't, and we're paying a price for that now. But we can still help Pakistan close this gap, this deficiency. A professional, disciplined, technologically modern civilian police is critical as you develop a judiciary, and I think the report talks about the importance of developing a system based on rule of law. It's a building block there. There's another element of timing that I'd like to raise here. Our unspoken compact with Musharraf in the early days after 9/11 was that he supported enlightened moderation, and we bought into that. And he promised to move his country to an elected civilian government. Well, he must do it now. There are risks in every scenario in the upcoming election, which is right upon us. Here are some of the risky scenarios, all of which could lead to violence in the streets, which must be avoided. First, he declares a modified martial law after the Supreme Court rules against his bid to bypass the constitutional provisions that he stepped down for 2 years before running for office. Another scenario is that the Supreme Court allows Musharraf to run in his uniform and that as a result, all or most of the opposition parties, particularly the Islamic parties, resign from the National Assembly. Another scenario, that the followers of Nawaz Sharif within the PMLQ, the ruling party, defect from the alliance, form an alliance with the religious parties on the right, and polarize the country along anti-Musharraf but anti-American sentiments as well, with a great deal of anger pouring into the streets. And finally, that Musharraf and Benazir Bhutto fail to reach an agreement on power sharing, and that the large and popular PPP party gets frozen out as the country moves to the right. These are only three illustrative scenarios which could conceivably end in violent protests in the streets, which would be defined by anti-Americanism. So what should we do to avoid the backlash? The CSIS report makes several good recommendations for the long term, and this applies to the immediate. The U.S. must be clear that our relationship is with the Pakistani people and not with a single man or a single woman or a single institution like the Army, but with the people. This will require our envoys and our diplomats to be visible, active, courageous in actions and words. Pakistanis are very sensitive to any indication of preference to Musharraf or the election, and this hurts him and it hurts us. Benazir Bhutto will visit Washington tomorrow, and she will get a lot of publicity. And in fact, my own organization, the Middle East Institute, will be a part of this because we're sponsoring a very large event on the Hill tomorrow at 10 o'clock in the Russell Building. But we should not leave any ambiguities in our support, that our support is for the democratic process and not for single individuals running for election. And ultimately, our plan B means that the U.S. must support a fresh group of leaders drawn from Pakistan's overwhelmingly young population, support reforms in the democratic process, and push for services of the people. Now, I did have a final point with regards to USAID and assistance, but I think my time is... He's getting restless over here, so I'm going to leave that out. Maybe it'll come up in the questions and answers. I don't know. But I hope in conclusion that my enthusiasm for this report is evident. I think it opens up many more lines of inquiry, and I applaud Rick and your team. You've done a terrific job. Thank you.
Thank you, Wendy. Thank you, and thanks to your team as well, Marvin and others who've been helpful to us throughout the process. So it's, we really appreciate your generosity in every way. And Bob, your turn.
Rick, thank you very much. I've watched the study as it took shape over the past 2 years.
I'll
put it up here. It's truly prescient. All the potential problems that you foresaw in U.S. relationship with Pakistan have come to pass. You and Karen and Craig Cohen, above all, and your collaborators deserve full marks. You put in a huge amount of research on the ground. Let's hope that the policymakers here and in Pakistan will pay close attention to your findings, although I'm somewhat dubious about how they respond to really good research. The study contains a number of excellent recommendations that warrant careful review. It also makes the key observation, despite all of our assistance, U.S. influence is more limited than both we and the Pakistanis believe. And looking at the future, we should keep this in mind. We must also keep in mind that Pakistan's military is not as receptive to U.S. persuasion and pressure as all as our level of assistance presupposes. Many Pakistanis see the United States as captured by the army, not interested in democracy. An erratic, fickle, fair-weather friend who shares them with attention and largesse when we're in time of crisis, but turns the other way once the crisis is over, leaving them alone to pick up the pieces. The cessation of all of our economic, social, and military assistance in October 1990 is a case in point. Tezzy was there at the time. I don't think this will be the case today, but and the study certainly argues against it. Pakistan is a long-term proposition. We can't afford to leave it alone. But the Pakistanis are not convinced, particularly when some in Congress are calling for reversion to sanctions or legislatively mandated restrictions upon our assistance. This has not served us well in the past. The U.S., on the other hand, tends to see Pakistan as duplicitous, telling us what we want to hear, only to change course shortly after the outset as soon as the going gets tough. That's why the study calls for much closer U.S.-Pakistani dialogue, particularly with the Army. Such a dialogue should be undertaken as soon as the elections are over and new power structures are in place for both the civilian and military sectors of government. We need a lot more clarity in our relationship, as you point out, Rick. At present, though, there are too many variables for such a dialogue to be meaningful. The Bush administration obviously is being forced to rethink its policy of all-out support for President Musharraf because of counterterrorism. His political blunders, the rather rapacious as well as authoritarian role of the army in Pakistani society, and the continued growth of jihadi-inspired violence in many parts of the country, plus the imminent elections, have precipitated a full-blown domestic political crisis. In addition to the ongoing violence, some variables that will determine the outcome of the crisis include the following. The newfound power of the Supreme Court and what it will say about elections and other issues. The burgeoning influence of civil society and the media, pressing for a fundamental redistribution of the power of the elite, civilian as well as military. Musharraf has opened this, what he now thinks is no doubt a Pandora's box. He can't put the lid back on it, which is good. The political influence of the Islamists, both the mainstream parties and the more radical splinter groups, which goes beyond the number of seats in provincial and national parliaments, including the relationship with the army. Attitude toward the United States and the perception of our role, the not-so-hidden hand. Will the U.S. continue to strongly support Musharraf and the army, perhaps in alliance with former Minister, Prime Minister Bhutto? Or will we step back and allow democracy to take its course, even if this means the return of Nawaz Sharif, something we apparently don't favor? What will President Musharraf decide? It appears he will be reelected by the current parliament with at least the tacit support of Benazir Bhutto's PPP. She's counting on a deal, apparently, where the upcoming general elections will give her a large vote and Musharraf will appoint her as prime minister. But can the two really work together in some murky form of cohabitation? For how long? Ms. Bhutto's past experience with the army certainly argues against it. Army may fear, on the other hand, that she will try to take away the massive perquisites that they have accumulated. What will the Pakistani army do, leaving aside President Musharraf, who's trying to consolidate his hold on senior positions, looking to ruling without uniform? However, there are signs of serious unrest and indiscipline, such as the surrender of 300 soldiers to Islamic militants in Waziristan without firing a shot. There seems to be some feeling that President Musharraf, under pressure from the United States, has forced them into a deadly confrontation with important elements of the Pakistani population. They're pulling back from that. How will the Army respond should there be large-scale popular demonstrations against Musharraf continuing as president? The police are ineffectual. Would the Army be willing to shoot at people in the streets? Let me throw out a few ideas to stimulate discussion. Wendy and Rick have already given you a lot. I'll add a few. Obviously, once the elections are over and new power structures emerge, the U.S. will need to enter into some sort of in-depth dialogue, which the study recommends. The new president and prime minister, leaders of the parliament and political parties, mainline Islamist groups, civil society, and the military, future leaders as well as current power holders. Wendy's talked about the need to help the people, which is obviously critical. We need to move our attention away from the army. But with respect to the army, I'll talk a little bit about that. We need to reaffirm our long-term commitment to support and coordinate with them. There's no getting around the essential role they play in so many elements of society, like it or not. This role can only be reduced gradually. It must be, but it can only be done gradually. In the meantime, we need to continue and expand military exchanges, education, and training, as well as providing essential weapons and equipment. At the same time, we need quietly to review and recalibrate our assistance to the military, particularly the coalition support funds, which need much closer oversight, as your study points out, Rick. As Wendy has said, the police deserve a lot more attention than they've been getting. Obviously, U.S. overt and covert assistance in the fight against extremism and terrorism in Pakistan must continue, including the vital tripartite relationship with Afghan and U.S. NATO military forces. We're the ones that are holding this thing together. We've had some success on the military side, certainly not on the political side. Now, given the limits upon what the Pakistan Army will do in the border areas and the deep-seated relationships of the Army and intelligence service with Pakistan's powerful Islamist organizations, cooperation with us has not been so bad. Likewise, willingness to allow U.S. military and intelligence operations inside Pakistan is all we could realistically expect. Wendy points out the backlash from some of the things we've undertaken. But we must avoid any frustration-driven temptation to undertake larger-scale direct U.S. military actions in areas such as Waziristan. This would provoke massive violent uprisings against us and the Pakistani army. It also produced nationwide political protests, which would endanger overall cooperation with the United States in the areas of counterterrorism and Islamic extremism. I think with the military, we need to be more careful than we have been in the past about pushing them to take military action in regions it considers to be problematic. Again, the backlash is evident. Together, we should consider additional means of resolving the problems, as the administration has been doing with regard to the tribal areas. Although fraught with difficulty, belatedly put into place, and slow to show results, there really is no alternative. We must also tackle upfront in a quiet manner the role of Pakistan's military and intelligence services in domestic politics, including their relationship with Islamist organizations. No more business as usual. And this means our military and the CIA have to weigh in strongly but quietly. It's very specific. Here are the things we won't continue to support. Rick, on the nuclear issue, your study raises the critical question of what's going to happen in the future with Pakistan's program. Here again, the centrality of the Army must be recognized, both the present and in the future. In addition to the major issues of security and extremism, the nuclear issues are an inescapable reason why the United States needs to continue a high level of support for Pakistan's army to retain its confidence. It seems to me we've come to enjoy a considerable degree of quiet cooperation in this extremely sensitive area. President Musharraf has established, finally, an effective structure for command and control of nuclear security, both internally and with respect to exports. It provides for substantial civilian oversight, as well as military control for security, developmental, and potential operational purposes. We should do all we can to see if this continues. In terms of the region as a whole, looking beyond the U.S.-Pakistan bilateral relationship, it seems to me extremely important that we establish several sets of dialogue with regional actors. This is as important, if not more so, for Pakistan than it is for the United States. A degree of cooperation and coordination will be essential to achieve what ought to be common objectives for the long term. With regards to Afghanistan, the issue is relatively clear. The U.S. has been laboring mightily to bring about closer cooperation. In addition to immediate security areas, we ought to continue discussions on better tribal and ethnic relationships between the two countries, perhaps even including the sensitive subject of the Durand Line, how it might be removed as a major irritant. Obviously, regional economic cooperation and Pakistan's role is an issue, including how to get Pakistan to open up trade between Afghanistan and India, and between Pakistan and India. This would mean allaying Pakistan's suspicions of India, including its motives in Afghanistan. I also would hope that in this context, the United States would reconsider its opposition to the Iran-Pakistan-India pipeline in order to enhance regional economic cooperation and reduce regional political tension. With India, we'd obviously need to discuss the usual array of issues, but a more forthcoming overall Indian posture and close cooperation with the United States could have a major impact upon Pakistan's future after the elections. We should encourage our Indian friends to adopt such a posture and take concrete steps to make it credible. Obviously, this would include Kashmir. China is absolutely critical for the future of Pakistan. We should press them systematically at all levels in an effort to forge a common understanding. I think it's unrealistic to expect common action. But on issues such as the future role of Pakistan's army, domestic and regional economic development, political relationships in the critical province of Balochistan, China has tremendous influence. Pakistan-India-China nuclear issues might also be a topic for discussion. Saudi Arabia is another country which must be a dialogue partner on Pakistan's future. Obviously, the subject of Pakistan's Islamist groups, how to reduce extremism, an issue, as well as the terrorist threat from the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. We must keep in mind that Pakistan faces ongoing internal tensions with regard to its Shia minority. Militant Sunni groups with support from Saudi Arabia to other wealthy Gulf states create problems with the Shia minority, which could become more violent. This would only encourage Iran to get more deeply involved in a negative way. Indirectly, we might try to bring Iran into the dialogue without too much expectation of success, but maybe an initial probe via India to see if there's any traction. And we have to be in close consultation with our European and Asian allies who have a stake in Pakistan's future. There are lots of other ideas, but I think my time is up, and we'll let Tezi take it from there.
Great. Thanks very much, Bob. As always, thoughtful. Tezi.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you very much for inviting me to be part of this distinguished panel. And I will join my colleagues in heaping praise on this excellent report. This is something that Craig and I talked about a good deal while it was in preparation, but I am very pleased to have been associated in any small way with it. It's very much his report, but I like to think that something we wrote about 3 years ago was in some respects a precursor. We did a report on Pakistan, which included a simulation, and we were simulating an India-Pakistan crisis with the purpose of trying to see what kind of leverage the United States might have to influence the course of events. And after we had played games for a day and a half, we sat down to do the usual post-mortem. And the State Department desk officer who had participated sort of blurted out, "You know, we don't begin to have enough on the table to make a real difference." Now, that was in 2004. So that some of what Craig has described was already on the table, although we hadn't done his research, so we didn't really have a clear idea of the magnitude of it. But I think this is one of the problems that his report has tried to highlight, and I particularly value the fact that they've looked at the tools for U.S. influence in much broader terms than simply the accounting of aid money however impressive that is. What I'd like to do is to go very briefly through a couple of issues that I think are fundamental to Pakistan's future. I do this against the background of another area where I very much agree with my colleagues, which is that for all kinds of reasons, including geography and regional politics, I find it difficult to imagine a time when Pakistan would not be very important to U.S. interests. And therefore, I think that, like it or not, U.S. policymakers will have to take Pakistan seriously and try to be productively engaged there. The first of these issues I've written down on my notes as democracy versus army. Now, that's a grand oversimplification, but the problems that I'm focusing on are, on the one hand, the role of the army in Pakistan politics, which has been very large for a couple of decades, and as each successive military government has come in, they have further expanded the role of the army politically and institutionally. On the other side of that seesaw is the issue of democracy, both electoral and governance democracy. I look on Pakistan as a country that has both the capacity of governing itself democratically and a yearning for being able to do so with fewer thumbs on the scale. In spite of the fact that the elected governments of the 1990s were highly problematic, and that when each of them departed, people seemed to be very glad to see the last of them. It's not a simple problem, but I think we are once again at one of those crossroads in Pakistan where people are looking more towards the democratic process as the way of changing governments. The second issue, which is very closely related, is institutions. This is something of a hobby horse of mine, for those of you who know me. But Pakistan's civilian institutions, most of them, have historically been quite weak, at least for the past 30 years. We're now in an unusual time when the judiciary got its back up and may turn out to be more powerful than it has been in Pakistan's previous history. We'll know something about that by the end of tomorrow, when the Supreme Court has promised us a ruling on a number of critical cases involving the election procedures. The judiciary is important, but it's not the only one. And for a healthier Pakistan in the future, the others also need to be strengthened. I think this is something that's a useful focus for U.S. assistance, but let's be very clear, as this report is, that this is a job that fundamentally needs to be done by Pakistanis for Pakistanis. It's tied in with the army issue, because it will be successful if the army allows it to happen. Third issue is the issue of extremist violence, and when I served in Pakistan 30 years ago, I would not have put that on the list. Some of this is from homegrown sources. Some of it is backwash from the Taliban in Afghanistan. But I think what makes it critical for the future of the Pakistani state is that at least some of those who are engaging in extremist violence are basically flouting the law and challenging the state. This is how I look at the crisis of the Red Mosque in Islamabad, which took place in July. One of the reason that it was so important for Musharraf to crack down on them was that these were people who had been kidnapping cops off the streets. No government can put up with that. Now, of course, the action the government took raised as many complications as it resolved, and ultimately wound up contributing to the weakness that the government suffers from now. But this basic challenge to the state, I think, is very important and makes it essential, regardless of the political aspects, that the next government of Pakistan be willing to defend the authority of the state, I would say, through democratic means. And I don't think that's a contradiction in terms. Fourth key issue is the neighborhood. Right at the moment, Afghanistan is the key neighborhood issue for the United States, and I would argue for Pakistan. I cannot tell you the anxiety I found during my last two visits to Pakistan in January and in May about the impact of the situation in Afghanistan on U.S.-Pakistan relations and on Pakistan. But I would urge that we not forget that India is a part of the neighborhood as well. It certainly still is the primal security threat from the Army's point of view. Right at the moment, India-Pakistan relations are in reasonably decent shape. Both governments want to keep some kind of a dialogue going, although it's not clear how far each side is prepared to take it. But this is the issue that won't go away. Fifth issue that's critical to the future of Pakistan is its economic health. The past few years have been relatively good from the point of view of economic growth, but social investment is still weak, and investment in creation of productive capacity is not as strong as one might think looking at those juicy economic growth numbers. And I think these are the two indicators that I would watch looking ahead. Now, in none of those issues did I mention the magic words Musharraf or Benazir Bhutto. My view is that we are watching the last act of the Musharraf drama, but it may be a fairly long last act. The U.S. obviously needs to work with whoever is in charge of Pakistan, but it also needs to work and to work visibly with the competing leaders. In this respect, I'm going to argue that we need to act like Americans who care about democracy in Pakistan as well. This has made several successive governments uncomfortable. It will continue to make them uncomfortable. But if you don't do that, then you wind up lashing your policy to one person. At some point, that one person is not going to look like the golden boy or golden girl, as the case may be. One of the fringe benefits of democracy is it provides you an honorable way of changing, even though the potential changee may not think the idea of change is all that good. But even if Musharraf is reelected, it's not going to be the same Pakistan, and it's not going to be the same government. We've already seen that it's going to be a more repressive government. Look at the arrests of parliamentarians in the past few days in the run-up to the presidential election. Look at the arrests that preceded Nawaz Sharif's visit home. I think you have to assume that if an election takes place under these circumstances and Musharraf wins, he will win a victory that doesn't confer much legitimacy, and that will dog him in the days to come. Let me now come briefly to the recommendations in the report. What I'd like to do is to pick out a couple that I think are particularly important. And my colleagues haven't left me a whole lot to say, but I've still got a couple of talking points up my sleeve. The first has to do with the section that's called Make the Region Safer, and particularly with the idea of a regional security approach. I very much agree with the thrust of the report that the United States needs to encourage a comprehensive approach that involves not just, but very importantly, three-way consultations among Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the United States, but that also in some fashion yet to be determined brings India and even Iran into the picture. In the case of India, this is something that makes the Pakistanis exceedingly uncomfortable for reasons we can all understand. But at the end of the day, if your basic view is that stability in Afghanistan will provide the best context for Pakistan to deal with its domestic problems and for the U.S. and Pakistan to cooperate, India and Iran play in that game. And finding a regional consensus that supports a more competent and stable government in Afghanistan is essential. The main enemy for this in Pakistan is not just suspicion of India. That could probably be overcome. The main enemy of this in Pakistan is the profound skepticism that Hamid Karzai is capable of this kind of turnaround. Second important recommendation has to do with finding a strategy for Pakistan that the U.S. can support in the tribal areas. I share this report's support for economic aid package that the United States has proposed. I also share even more passionately its opposition to U.S. direct military intervention there, and I agree with Bob Oakley that there is nothing that would quite so efficiently galvanize all Pakistani opinion against the United States. The problem is the U.S. did put heavy pressure on Pakistan to intervene in the tribal areas. Unfortunately, perhaps, having intervened with the army, I think Pakistan is condemned to keep at it and to try in whatever ways it can to integrate the tribal areas into Pakistan. This has not been fun for the army. They haven't looked good. They've lost a lot of people. They have, on successive occasions, tried to negotiate their way out of continuing the operation. No surprise that this hasn't worked. The biggest problem, and I'm not enough of an expert on the tribal areas to offer a solution, is the apparent absence of functioning local social structures within which to work. Partly this is the result of all of these military operations. But I see no alternative to continuing a certain amount of trial and error experimentation to find a solution that will work. My final point concerns something that's implicit in Craig's recommendations, but that I'd like to hit over the head. And that is that U.S. aid is not an all-or-nothing package. In a sense, the much maligned cutoff of aid in October of 1990 was an opportunity when the United States tried to exercise the leverage that its assistance provided. The hope had been at that time that the threat of an aid cutoff would be sufficient to dissuade Pakistan from continuing its nuclear program. I would argue that it bought us some time,
sure.
Not a huge amount of time. But once you were in the position where you had to implement a congressionally required aid cutoff, you had discharged that weapon, and you had very little else to play with. Insofar as the presence of U.S. assistance gives it leverage to support U.S. interests, this is leverage to work with Pakistan in the areas where our interests run in parallel. Arguably, it's leverage to withdraw certain aspects of aid if we find they are not serving U.S. interests anymore. But this is a tool, if we find it necessary to use it, that has to be used with great sophistication and with a recognition that we're going to have to live with the consequences, because even if we have a parting of the ways, Pakistan will still matter to us. Thank you.
We have about 30 minutes for your questions and comments. What I'd like to do is to ask you to wait for the microphone. The gentleman in the middle seems to have been giving me the most winks during the entire presentation. So why don't we start with him? What I'd like to do is to ask you to identify yourself. Please limit your question or your comment to 1 minute. Because it's, as you can see, there are at least 15 or 20 people who would like to speak up. I'd like to, and then I'll collect about five or six of them, and so the panel doesn't feel compelled to have each of us speak to every comment that's made. And so we can divide them up. As you hear the question or comment, just give me a little signal whether that's one that interests you, and then I'll call on you if you would. And so why don't we start right here in the middle right now.
I'm Stanley Kerber with the Cato Institute. It seems to me the most important fact right now in Pakistan is the growing unwillingness of soldiers to fight. There are increasing number of stories I'm seeing of soldiers deserting, laying down their arms, just surrendering. If the soldiers are unwilling to fight, if this grows, then what do we do?
Great. Thank you, Stanley, for setting such a good example. Vanessa, why don't we go right here, and then we'll Shannon, why don't you go over to this side next? And, yes.
My name's Bob Berg. I was the founding director of evaluation at USAID, and I think the golden rule I had was that the larger the program, the less scrutiny it has. So when Ambassador Schaefer mentioned institutional weakness, I thought she was going to talk about the U.S. government for a moment. We have a Deputy Secretary of State, and we have the NSC that's supposed to coordinate and have, if you walk in and say, here's how much the aid program is, and here's what it's supposed to do. So do you have any comments on that? Secondly, if a country feels, if it reads, let's say, the Goldman Sachs report and says it's going to be in the N11, it's going to have a GDP that's going to rival great European countries in 40 years, then it may feel it has less interest in complying on an aid program, that it's going to have a post-aid future that comes fairly soon. So I think this notion about when it, you know, what, how the economy is going to play out is an extremely important point, and I wonder if others on the panel have a view on that.
Great. Excellent questions. Thanks, Bob. Yes. We'll get the two of you together.
Charlie Flickner, I was appropriations clerk during the time that some of you served over there. My question is a simple one, elaborating on what Bob said. Tools. Does the United States government have the institutional capacity and the tools to do effective police training, to work in the FATA area, and to do educational assistance? And will the security rules that the U.S. Embassy has in Pakistan allow any of these programs to be carried out?
Right next to you. Yes. Thanks, Charlie.
Colonel Dutta, Foreign Policy Association. Every time army has taken over in Pakistan, the main reason, or one of the major reasons, has been the rampant corruption amongst the civilian regimes. Now, and USA has always advocated the return to democracy. Is it essential democracy to be wedded with corruption, especially in the areas of Pakistan? Can there be a midway course between military as well as the democratic rule, and especially to advance the interests of America? Would there be a United States approval of such a system?
Okay, why don't we do one more over here? Let's get Jim Moody. Come to the panel.
Hi, I'm Jim Moody. I was in Pakistan with the Peace Corps in the early days, and go back from time to time. I'm now in a charity which helps village-level development. Seems just an observation. It seems to me one of the most important things we can do is help in education. About 40-50% of the villages have no teachers in the school. They're on the map as having teachers, but they don't have them. Those are the simple kind of budgetary assistance and assistance we might be able to really make a real difference. Education is so crucial, and particularly keeping girls in school is particularly crucial. Just an observation on earlier, a question about the earlier point about the drone. You know, who is it that decides that we're going to send a drone out to bomb a village in northern Pakistan and suddenly plunge our standing in the whole country, vitiating all the effort we made to raise our standing with the post-earthquake assistance? And one final observation. The last time I was in Pakistan, I asked the Consul General if he could come with me to visit some villages where we were applying assistance, private assistance to a charity. He said, oh, no, I can't do that. The Osama would never let me do that. I have to stay in the consulate. If we're pinned behind walls, Wendy, and can't get our people out, we're not going to be very effective in promoting our message. He said, our security people have the following doctrine: zero tolerance for any untoward incident. Therefore, we can't move around.
Okay, well, I think you've given us a few challenges here. Why don't we, who would like to go first? Do you want to just go down the panel again? Tessie, why don't you take a quick bite, and we'll go the reverse this way, and then we'll just move it around. Feel free for you to jump in if you have a follow-up.
Let me talk about the economic outlook. Pakistan's economic growth has been quite satisfactory in recent years. There's a lot of questions about the overall per capita GDP figures that the government is putting out. I don't think the Pakistanis foresee a post-aid future for themselves in any near or medium term, in any policy-relevant time horizon. There's always a problem figuring out how much influence and response you're going to have in an aid program, because countries have their own ideas and they have their own priorities. And aid, in some sense, is an effort to negotiate a shift in priorities. In Pakistan, I think you've had the further problem that if you go up high enough in the government, the assumption is the United States needs us more than we need them. This, I think, makes it particularly important how we focus U.S. assistance. Wendy has given one golden rule: focus on people. I think the first golden rule is perhaps even more important, and that is that having now got through the sort of initial period, don't give cash. I fully agree with the importance of education, Jim. One of the fascinating things, though, is who's doing education. The madrasas are doing it. Lots of private organizations are doing it. If you drive to the airport in Lahore, you know, you can't go 50 meters without seeing yet another billboard for some kind of an English medium school that's geared not necessarily towards the elite who live in very big houses, but towards the urban lower middle class who want to live in somewhat bigger houses. I don't think one should look on corruption as the inevitable partner of democracy. For starters, it hasn't been limited to democracy. Uprooting it is excruciatingly difficult and probably the work of a generation. I find it interesting, however, that the government of India, which in 1999 was so determined not to deal with this new general that they canceled a SARC meeting, is now very quietly expressing some nervousness about the possibility that he might leave office. So it seems that India is, along with many other countries, accustomed to doing business with a particular person and nervous about the prospects for change.
Well, I just want to second your recommendation about education. And one of the distressing things is, Tezzy knows, when we applied our sanctions in October 1990, because nobody had thought it through, they weren't calibrated, we cut off a very, very good public education program in the provinces dealing with women's education, which the Pakistani government had accepted. We were working together. But unfortunately, the willingness of successive Pakistani governments, whether they're civilian or military, to put their own resources into economic and social improvement is very, very limited. It's very hard to substitute, whether it's indigenous private education or whether external education programs, and there are a lot of them, the willingness of the Pakistani government, and this includes the parliament, not merely the executive branch, to really put the resources into social programs. With respect to the army, my only suggestion is that we need to talk a lot more to them and have a real dialogue at several different levels, rather than just assuming that they want to do certain things and will do them, and getting very, very angry when they don't. But I think the crisis within the Pakistani army is now very, very serious, perhaps more serious than we've had before. And the repercussions there are just immense. We have a lot of contact at various levels, a lot of education, a lot of exchanges, a lot of training. We have to use it in a sensible way rather than sort of saying, okay, your job is to do this.
Thank you. when I left Pakistan, I went back and worked in the as the assistant administrator in USAID in the Asia Near East Bureau, and I found that a very gratifying experience. But I do believe that there's been, again, back to the timing issue, there's been an evolution in the way we approach our assistance programs as the United States and as AID over the years. And we have gotten away from some of the methods that worked in the 60s and 70s. Let me be specific. One of the things that I really liked about this report, and Rick, who's also from AID and also was, like me, a deputy high commissioner for refugees, he preceded me, actually, in Geneva, and has some solid program management. It shows in this report. This report made a very cogent, I think, accurate defense or argument for results-based management. And I think perhaps that's not what we don't do enough of in our assistance programs. We tend to look at programs, we USAID, but look, it's not just us. It's the UN, it's it's CETA, it's DFID, it's other bilaterals as well. As reporting on activities, we spend money on education. We report that we succeeded because we built 3,000 schools. Great. We go up and talk to Charlie Flitner and say, see, we spent the money that the Hill gave us. Well, we built 3,000 schools. But we should be asking how many students were trained in those schools. And then we should be asking how many of those students got jobs afterwards. I mean, it's the impact that we need to build in as our metric. And we need to get better at that. Not just AID, but particularly the UN, but others as well. That's not easy, but we can do a better job in the way we spend money. Well, how do we spend money in a place like Pakistan? How does the UN or other agencies do it? Well, we've become a little more than contracting agencies, let's face it. In the early day, I like to say that the U.S. hasn't had a good idea since the Peace Corps. And the season, I really think so. We haven't reached out to the peoples of this world in an effective way since our kids went out and sat in villages and ate fufu, ate curry, and really connected with people. Now, Peace Corps wasn't really a development agency, and you didn't get long-term development, but you did get people-to-people contact, and it did lead to some good things. We don't do that anymore. We sit in compounds. We're prohibited from going out because of fear and security interests, and we've lost that contact. I think we ought to just get a grip on this security issue. A lot more can be done. We can get out a lot more without going out as ninjas in heavy armor, and we can reach people a lot better. And this report opens the door to studies like this, and that we ought to look at it in a much more thoughtful way. Now, Bob touched the issue from Cato. Thank you for that. That's a hard question to answer. I don't know the answer. I'm not a military person. But I do kind of have a notion that maybe the answer dances around the issue of who's Al-Qaeda and who's Taliban. Are they the same people? Because I don't think they are. And I don't think that our response to radicalized Pashtuns is the same as to the Uzbeki or the Algerian who's being hidden in that village. And this might be what the soldiers who were unwilling or to shoot at, Pashtun villagers, might be telling us. I don't know the answer, but I think this is a line of inquiry that we ought to follow.
Yeah, let me just take on a couple of these questions. I don't think we quite answered as many questions as were put out here. I do think that Wendy's earlier points about how to deal with this the unwillingness to fight. I mean, she talking about the police, having a capable police who are locally based but have national standards clearly doesn't exist. There was nobody we spoke to in our visit in Pakistan who spoke about the police in a favorable way or had any confidence in them whatsoever. We also saw the direction of the military and the kinds of challenges that they're likely to face internally in their country to be deeply troubling and a point of great potential explosion, because it's primarily a Punjab and Pashtun military, and they've been fighting their own countrymen in the east and in the west, but they haven't really been challenged to deal with the authority issues amongst their own people. And when faced with their own people, they're going to have a much harder task. And so we thought that this moment that's arriving right now that you're describing, Stanley, was probably about to surface, and then it would be a much greater problem, compounded by the fact that the military has found more fun things to do, like run businesses and run the government. So running the barracks gets pretty dull after you've had a chance to be a captain of industry and a governor. And this has happened in other places. And so those two trend lines, I think, are terribly troubling. But again, you have to have some form of security and public safety. And Wendy's point on that in her comments, I think, was right on. Charlie, a quicker answer to your question is no, we don't have the capacity. But yes, we should have it, because it's ridiculous to look at a challenge like Pakistan and realize that we don't have the toolkit. I mean, America doesn't have a toolkit. That is not that hard. It's basically a hammer and, you know, a screwdriver and a couple of other items. So it's not that fancy, but we just don't have it. We're ready. The United States and the global community are ready for a problem in East Timor. We're not ready for a problem in a place like Pakistan, and it's going to hurt us badly. I think the last question that I thought maybe we didn't touch on was the pinned down U.S. In our report, we talk about many, many, many more American presence posts. You've got to get to a point where there's critical mass. You have to obviously get over the zero standard. People have to accept that there's going to be risk if we're going to have any influence in these places. So our risk capacity, we've totally succumbed to the so-called security officers' standard. And I don't find that they know the country any better than anybody else does in most of the places I go. So it's really one of these things that we have to get a handle on. And finally, to who makes the decision to use the drone, I would hope it'd be pretty darn close to the President of the United States, because when you're fiddling around with World War III, it's the kind of issue that you should have somebody who's at the very top being aware of what's going on and making that call. And by the way, and I happen to agree with the panelists who said that it's really thoroughly unwise for us to be thinking about direct military action. Tessie, just one last word, and then I know there are many more questions out here. So
yeah, on the security thing, one of the consequences is that we have fortresses in Pakistan with very good and dedicated people who know the government fairly well and who haven't had any opportunity to get to know the country. And this really is a handicap making policy. The second point, I wanted to underline the implication of what Wendy said about results-based management. You're not going to know how many kids are in that school for a couple of years. You're not going to know how many of them have jobs for several more years. This implies that you have to have a longer time horizon mm-hmm. before you decide that you're giving up on aid.
Good. Okay, let's give you a chance. We've got lots more comments we could throw in. Why don't we go work the back of the room and come forward there. Yeah.
Thank you.
Please.
I'm Fazia Deeba. I'm a SAIS John Hopkins alum and a development practitioner from Balochistan, Pakistan. I would like to draw your attention to another perspective, which I found slightly missing out in this report as well. And that is, well, first of all, commendable recommendation of drawing your attention towards the people of Pakistan. When people of Pakistan would say that a few years ago, they were named as nationalists and separatists and God knows what and what. But I'm glad that an institution like CSIS is with the people of Pakistan. And I would really want to draw your attention towards a difference between local country, within country, subnational issue and an international issue, which is actually pertaining to half of Pakistan, which is the southern half of Pakistan. Even this report is more focused towards the northern because it gives a feeling as if the interest of US in Pakistan is pertaining to terrorism only. Although there is another perspective to the interest as well, and that is the energy perspective, the oil and gas, and the rest. So please do keep consideration of that as well. So first of all, we need to define the interest itself. Why is the interest there in that region, first of all? And if it is only pertaining to terrorism, then you may be right in just focusing on the tribal areas, Fatah, Bajor, and all. But do not forget that the border extends down till the Iran border and the coastal area as well, which is actually all about Balochistan and Sindh that I'm talking of. Now we come to that very important word that Ambassador Wendy Chamberlain is using again and again, time. Timing is really important. I wonder if this report was offered 3 or 4 years ago, would you have a belief that this will be acted upon? And if yes, why wasn't it done? And if no, what makes you believe now that it will be acted upon? So, because these are the things that people were saying even then. It's just that CSIS had not composed it in a report form, but people were very openly saying all this even then, but it was not listened to. And what makes you believe that it will be listened to now? And that's a bit of my reservation. But
okay, I'm going to ask you to wrap it up, please.
Yes, and my wrapping up question to you would be, the military of Pakistan, which is quite involved in military action in Balochistan, as well as in Fatah, these are two different types of military action. Fatah is a terrorism action, and military of Balochistan, in Balochistan, which is half of Pakistan, is actually acting against people who want autonomy. Now, the report does not talk of anywhere this underpinning issue of the country, Pakistan, which is the provincial autonomy, which gives rise to this this anti-federal government notion and feelings, which then ultimately show up as anti-American feeling as well. And this is not only a problem of Balochistan and Sindh, also Cholistan, name it, northern areas, name it, Skardu, Gilgit, everywhere this anti-autonomy feelings are there.
Okay, thank you very much. I'll take that question when we get around to it. Why don't we get the gentleman right next to you just to speed up time, and Vanessa, why don't you then go over here.
I'm Hilton Root, George Mason University. I read the report and I greatly admire it. I do also see that the report was very silent on this question of the devolution of power, the preponderance of Punjab in all of the decision-making institutions, and it's silent on the need for jurisdictional reconfiguration, which distributes power more evenly among the various population groups.
I'll be happy to take those two questions. Yes.
Thank you. My name is Ahmed Khalid, originally from Afghanistan. I'm a graduate student at Georgetown University. The Pakistani government appears to have scaled down its military presence and also counterinsurgency and counterterrorism efforts in tribal areas. And with the transition of government from the military to the civilian, it will become even more. And one of your recommendations was to curtail the U.S. aid to the military. So do you think that it will not make the situation more ripe and conducive for terrorist organizations in the tribal areas to further regroup and make their activities more institutionalized? And also, what's your idea that how the U.S. should deal with the safe havens that exist in the tribal areas of Pakistan? Thank you.
Let me go right there, Vanessa.
Hi, I'm Alex Thier from the U.S. Institute of Peace. Fantastic panel, and somewhat following up on that last question. I think one of the most important things that you've said in your report is the recommendation that the U.S. Relationship with Pakistan cannot focus exclusively on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border areas, that it's a much bigger country with much broader interests. That being said, the fortunes of NATO and the U.S. geostrategic interests in the region are so closely tied with Afghanistan right now. And so long as we continue to fight and die in Afghanistan, there's going to need to be a critical political response to the question of the continued use of Pakistan as a base for the insurgency. And so I applaud the recommendations of the report in terms of the long-term focus on rebuilding the relationship with Pakistan, but would like to hear more about how you balance that with the very intense short-term political interests of dealing with that insurgency and the risks that it poses to stability in Afghanistan and the region.
We'll do one more right up front here, Vanessa, and then we'll move to the panel here. Start with you, Bob, this time, if we could.
Hi, my name is Muhammad Ali. I'm a journalist with Voice of America. It was a very elaborate and informative panel, and thank you for the great, very elaborate discussion. Just two very small points. What is your assessment about the current progress in the talks between People's Party and Musharraf? How confident are you that they're able to reach an agreement in the foreseeable future? And secondly, considering the likely prospects of any transition towards a democratic dispensation, do you expect any change in Islamabad's approach and policy towards a war on terror, or will it be the same?
Bob, do you want to jump in and start us off, if you would? I think we have about 5 minutes. Does that seem about right?
First, the question of how much support we're getting from Pakistan vis-a-vis Afghanistan. I think people tend to ignore the very, very large amount of assistance that our military forces are getting and have gotten in conducting operations in Afghanistan. It's still going on. Logistics support, sometimes paid for by Pakistan in exchange for money that we give in coalition support funds. The use of Pakistani bases, extremely important. Protecting our forces that are using Pakistani bases. Again, not talked about. But this is vital for the U.S. and NATO forces in continuing to do what we're doing in Afghanistan. How much success we're having in Afghanistan is a question, but nevertheless, that part of it is essential. I think it's also important that we work with the Pakistani army in dealing with problems in the tribal areas. We can't leave it alone. On the other hand, as I've said before, we have to have a much better mutual understanding of who's going to be doing what, where, when, how to use the civilian tools as well as the military tools. It's going to take a long time distinguishing Uzbeks, Wendy's, from others. Nevertheless, we can't walk away from it. I think it's if Mrs. Bhutto becomes the prime minister, if she has a certain amount of power, I'm not at all sure how the Islamist groups are going to look at her and vice versa. So I don't know. It's a very, very complicated question. I'm not sure that she'd be able to pursue much of a different policy. But it's something we have to consider, and I'm not sure that overall in the country as a whole, the Islamist response to Benazir is something we're going to find very, very helpful.
As far as the negotiations between Benazir Bhutto and Musharraf is concerned, I don't know. You can ask Mrs. Bhutto when she arrives tomorrow. If they do reach an agreement, I wonder how long it will last. But the key question is, how is Pakistan going to be governed, and will that government have enough legitimacy to have a decent shelf life? And I think those are the points that I would watch. The lady in the back asked about subnational versus international issues and terrorism versus energy as drivers of U.S. interests. Yes, these things are all important. I think, however, that for policymakers today, terrorism is by far the dominant issue in U.S. policy towards Pakistan, and there's really nothing in second place.
I don't know if I know enough to add much more to this conversation. I think the questions get at some of the most important questions that I think still do face us. How can we meaning Islamabad and the United States and NATO and the international community, be more effective along the border in stopping the insurgency that is troubling both within Pakistan and within Afghanistan? I don't think we have the answer. I think part of the problem is that the way we've approached it collectively has changed over time. I mean, the first impulse was from Musharraf's part, very early in 2001, he said, look, no central government has ever really established control in that area. This is the time to do it, and the way to do it is to win the support of the people. That didn't happen for a number of reasons. A second approach was to go in with foot soldiers and do it that way, and through aerial bombing, and that certainly has not been effective. And this leaves us to where we go next. Yes, we can't abandon it, but no, we haven't found the right approach. And I think that there's elements of this report that makes a strong case that we need to look not just in not apply results-based management just to our aid programs, but to our military programs as well. Is it working? No, it's not working. So we're not doing it right, and we need to look again to see what would work. And you're going to get that answer from the people. You're not going to get it from Tampa or from Brussels. We need to understand more about what it is that the Pashtuns who operate on both sides of the border and it's the sea in which these fish are swimming want and need, and find the way to cooperate with us in that way.
Just a couple couple of quick points. I think that when we started thinking about the Northwest, we realized that everywhere we went in Pakistan, we ran into sizable populations of people from that part of the country everywhere else, in Karachi and Lahore and whatnot, and partially because our leader, Ayub, was from that region and had grown up in that region. And so whenever we had a hole in our program, that's where we got our help. And so we realized this is a very powerful network of people. And so if you start thinking about the country as being the people of even that region as being all living in that region, it would be you would have a really too limited a view of Pakistan. And then also, obviously, the nonstop flights out of Peshawar to the Emirates and whatnot. There's a lot going on, so you have to think of it as a more sophisticated place with a greater influence and a broader population than probably we're going to approach it by bringing aid programs just to the geographic spot as well, although that needs to be probably the emphasis. So that would be one way we would take on that issue. The last thing, just to speak to the question of the importance of the devolution, we strongly agree with you and apologize if the way we've addressed it is not as forceful as you would like. We have a recommendation in here which reads, encourage the devolution of responsibilities from Islamabad to the four provincial governments and to the local level. Pakistan is too dynamic to be well run from the center. President Musharraf's devolution of authority was an important first step, but it did not decentralize enough responsibility from the federal government to the provinces. A domestic regional strategy is needed. And then we iterate that with some detail. But again, this is not the last word. We did not get to Balochistan. It was the only province we did not visit. We are sure we underappreciated that and look forward to learning more about it, recognize that it does have a different flavor. But we also saw the devolution as being a good way at getting beyond the military's control as well, since the military tends to be dominated by certain provincial representations. And in terms of the influence, thank you all for being here. This is one of the important steps for any of these ideas to be communicated in Washington. We do recognize that timing is critical. We do think that our research process of engaging virtually everybody that we could find that's been involved with Pakistan policy at an early date opens up the likelihood that they may be more open to what we say in our report. But we think that this government, our government right now, is looking for alternatives to their present approach. So that's helpful. We know that the new ambassador there is eager for that dialogue. And but we also recognize that this is a very big task. It's a huge change at virtually every level of our government and the Pakistani government. And we don't have a public that really is very well informed about this situation. And so there's a lot of work to be done. We appreciate your being here, and we see that as a critical step in pushing this issue forward. So thank you all very much. Thanks to Craig Cohen for his good work, and thanks to our distinguished panel.